This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
It's not limited to Howard Zinn. In fact, there's a broader attack on critical education studies. James Lowen has written a piece in which he pointed out that when he wrote a book about sundown towns and highlighted the case of Greenberg, Indiana, which is where Honda built a non-union auto factory recently in the state of Indiana with a huge subsidy organized by Mitch Daniels, that he was supposed to give three talks organized by the Indiana Civil Rights Commission. Those talks were canceled under pressure by Governor Daniels' office. So it's a very politicized situation. And they're aware that there's a certain kind of history which is dangerous to people like Mitch Daniels. If you teach a history that is about the history of social movements, about the history of people challenging those in power, about the importance of unions, about the importance of civil rights struggles, that threatens the agenda of Mitch Daniels as governor, as president of the university, and it was someone with national political aspirations.
Professor Cornell West, we just have 30 seconds. Your response, you knew Howard Zinn well. You, too, are a professor who writes many critical books, critical of U.S. policy, domestic and foreign.
Well, I want to salute the work of my dear brother here, and I was blessed to read an introduction to Howard Zinn's writings on race. But the important thing to keep in mind is that it's a compliment to Howard Zinn because it shows the power of his work. And it's Howard Zinn today, it's Ira Katznelson, Eric Foner, David Brian Davis, Barbara Fields, Robin Kelly. Tomorrow, it's part of a larger discourse that says, let's tell the truth about the American past and present, and let's do it in such a way that it relates to everyday people, especially the young people coming along. And, oh, we got a lot of hope among the young folk. They're tired of all this hypocrisy, mendacity, and criminality.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Professor Cornell West and Anthony Arnov, editor and collaborator with Howard Zinn. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now!, produced by a remarkable group of people, including Mike Burke, Renee Felser, Amati Nirmin Sheikh, Dina Gunter. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is More Talk Radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is Janine Bell, author of the new book, Hate Thy Neighbor, Move-In Violence and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing.
We are here tonight to show solidarity with prison strikers at Pelican Bay Correctional Institute in Northern California.
We have the biggest prison system in the world. We have the highest incarceration rates in the world. If we have a section of the population that's that big, that disenfranchised, and is being dehumanized to the extent that they're living in little cells that are 6 by 8 foot, 23 out of 24 hours of the day in that cell, we're looking at a situation that's going to be popping up pretty soon here. And you think we're starting to feel the first rumblings of that with this prison strike right now.
On Prison Pipeline, July 22nd, hear the rally at the Portland Justice Center in solidarity with the striking prisoners. That's Prison Pipeline, July 22nd at 6:30 p.m.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC. Providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer, as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Today is Monday, July 22nd. You are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey. You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO, at 90.7 in the metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and it is 104.3. Did I say that right? I thought I flipped the numbers there. 104.3 in Philomath and Corvallis, 90.7 in the metro area. I think I said that. I could be wrong, engineer. And then in the ether, on the web, KBOO.FM.
In 1959, Lorraine Hansberry play A Raisin in the Sun debuted.
Oh. Monday.
On Broadway, bringing to the national awareness the issues surrounding housing desegregation in Americans' neighborhood. In 1968, federal legislation known as the Civil Rights Act of 1968 provided equal housing opportunities regardless of race, creed, or national origin, signed by Lyndon Johnson. The issue of segregation in housing has been an issue that has haunted this nation for many, many decades. Our guest this morning is an author and scholar who has investigated the issues surrounding this issue, and we are pleased to welcome with us Janine Bell, who is the Professor of Law and Louis F. Neisser Faculty Fellow at the Moral School of Law at Indiana University. She is the author of articles and books, and her most recent book, in which we will focus on this morning, is entitled Hate Thy Neighbor, Move-In Violence and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing. We invite you to join our conversation in a little while. Our numbers are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com.
And good morning. Good morning. We're glad that you are able to join us here, Professor Bell, and to share with us not only the history of move-in violence, but some of the strategies and solutions that we can employ to really make it not only a land of opportunity, but to really make it true that we have freedom of association and freedom to pursue happiness and the opportunity for housing. And that seems like a really basic thing, but when we look at the fact that here in the United States, we still have not only actions and expressions of move-in violence, but it has morphed into new forms, and it continues to raise its ugly head.
Good morning, Celeste.
Absolutely. So first, I want to talk about your book. Why Hate Thy Neighbor? What was it about move-in violence and this persistence of racial segregation in housing that grabbed your attention and just made it necessary to write a book to illustrate that this is still an issue that we're dealing with?
I was so surprised by it. I've integrated neighborhoods all my life, and I integrated them peacefully. So when I learned in researching my first book that this sort of violence was occurring in the 1990s, I was shocked by it, and I felt I had to write about it.
And maybe initially you can give us an explanation by the term move-in violence. What do you mean by that term?
Move-in violence is violence directed at minorities, racial and ethnic minorities. In the book, I speak predominantly about African Americans, directed at them after they've moved to white neighborhoods, predominantly white neighborhoods. In some cases, they're the first person to move in. So these are acts of harassment. They can range from cross-burning to assaults.
One of the things about this particular type of response is that, as we've noted, it is violent, which means that it is extra legal. However, in many parts of the country, it's not necessarily just extra legal. It happens within the aspect of the law. Can you kind of balance a little bit this dual nature of move-in violence?
The I focus predominantly on actions that are actually illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if you call someone a slur on the sidewalk in front of their home, you are actually violating the law if you're harassing them with this. So I make sure that in the book I talk about violence that is actually illegal. There's all sorts of incidents that occur that are not illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Involving minorities who've moved to white neighborhoods, shunning, for instance, coldness. That is also part of the experience, but it is not behavior that's illegal.
So we started looking at, I think, some of the causes of well, I don't want to call it causes, because what we're looking at is a very visceral and emotional and hurtful response. But I think when I say cause, what I want to say is we look at some of the factors that spark it. I, as a young person, was the oldest in the family, where my father had got a good job, wanted to improve the situation, bought a house. We moved into a neighborhood that had all of the amenities my parents were looking for, good schools, yard, businesses nearby, parks nearby, and what have you. The problem was is the neighborhood we moved in was predominantly white. But what we were looking for was, having recently moved to the city, a place that matched not only our financial opportunities, but matched my parents' visions of the American dream. So you have families that are moving into neighborhoods thinking this is going to be some place that has fertile ground for our dreams and our kids, and it's not. It's not necessarily that they're looking at moving someplace that automatically doesn't want them. It's just looking for a chance to move and improve life chances. When people are moving into new neighborhoods, how many of the folks that you interviewed kind of mirrored that same vision? We're just looking for a place to settle down that matches our dreams. We're not necessarily trying to be quote unquote pioneers or groundbreakers.
Almost all of the accounts that I talk about in the book, ranging from individuals I interviewed to accounts that I found in the in cases, legal cases in popular press, involved individuals who are trying to move up, right? They want to increase their children's life chances. They want to increase their wealth. They're not trying to, as you indicate, be pioneers. And something frequently quite awful happens to them.
We're speaking this morning with Janine Bell, a professor of law at Indiana University, and she's the author of Hate Thy Neighbor, Move in Violence and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing. We invite your calls at 503-231-8187 or email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. We are especially interested in people who have integrated neighborhoods, and tell us the challenges that you might have faced in moving into your new neighborhood. Dr. Bell, Could you share with us a little bit in terms of your sense of American housing patterns? 40 years after the civil rights movement was at its height, we continue to live more or less in segregated environment. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It's quite sad. The typical white person lives in a neighborhood that is 75% white. Of course, many individuals who are white live in neighborhoods that are even whiter than that. The typical person of color, it of course varies by racial and ethnic background. Latinos and Asian Americans tend to be less segregated than African Americans, who live in neighborhoods, who live in the most segregated neighborhoods in this country. And class is not necessarily a factor in this, meaning middle-class African Americans live in neighborhoods that are much blacker, for instance, than you'd expect, given their income. They can afford to pay for better neighborhoods. And one of the things that I argue is that they tend to live in these neighborhoods that are poorer and have fewer services because they're worried about issues of violence.
That's kind of a fascinating issue just in and of itself. I want to go back a little bit and talk about the kind of roots of this particular dynamic. In your book, one of the things that you do is you kind of lay out the roots of contemporary move-in violence. And can you just kind of lay out for our listeners the way we as Americans have kind of constructed this idea that this is my territory, this is not an open territory or open neighborhood or open community, and you're not welcome here? And I understand that in some instances, this is not necessarily about just neighborhoods. It could be about towns.
Yes. Historically, the federal government, of course, supported segregated neighborhoods. This is before the passage of the Fair Housing Act, by loaning money based on how sort of white a neighborhood was. So, you know, that's federal government support for neighborhoods that are segregated. And coding particular neighborhoods that are mixed or predominantly African-American in ways that wouldn't be eligible for federal loans. This is before the passage of the Fair Housing Act. So that is one way that individuals developed attachment for particular types of neighborhoods and particular sort of makeups of neighborhoods. The lack of investigation of crimes directed at minorities who cross the color line, so to speak, is another way that the federal government and state governments supported. And in a way, sort of taught Americans that these particular neighborhoods, you know, looked, you know, the way they looked was something that one should value. So that supported the entire idea of white neighborhoods.
So when a neighborhood is integrated, certainly people expect that federal and state and local laws protect them. You talk in your book about the move-in violence and those activities which are illegal. What type of protections are offered in different neighborhoods or localities, and what type of laws either protect or recourse do people have when they are subject to this these types of violence?
All right. Individuals should know that in a variety of jurisdictions, there are state hate crime legislation. There is state hate crime legislation that may provide a remedy. There may be federal hate crime. There may be federal fair housing remedies also available. Federal civil rights laws. But the key, of course, is investigation. You need to report it to the police. The police have to be receptive such that they gather information to find a perpetrator. And then prosecutors have to be interested in prosecuting these sorts of crimes. Unless you have all of those factors, then the remedies are just remedies on paper.
Well, why would they only be remedies on paper? Because I think for a lot of people, if they are in a situation like this, the expectation would be that some larger, more enlightened body of people or some larger, more enlightened dynamic would actually be a real source of remedy and not just a nominal source of remedy.
It's sad, but things can die at a very low level. Mm. So, for instance, I described one hate crime in the book where a cross was burned, and this is in the early 1990s in St. Paul, Minnesota. And the police officers reported quickly after the cross burning, and they asked the family if, you know, do you know who did this? And the family said, no, it was in the middle of the night. We didn't know who did this. And the police said, you know, well, okay. And they packed up and left, not even taking the cross, of course. That would have died at the level of law enforcement if it hadn't been for sort of, you know, a perpetrator bragging about it. To some friends. The perpetrator in that particular case decided that they charged him under a statute. The statute was struck down by the Supreme Court. In this particular case, there was a federal prosecution of the individual who burned the cross, and he was convicted under federal law. But you have to sort of, that's a lot of action that you needed in this particular case. And in the vast majority of cases, it's easy for it to fall through the cracks.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I am here with my co-host, Cecil Prescott. My name is Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Professor Janine Bell, who is the author of the book Hate Thy Neighbor, Move-In Violence and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing. And we'd like to have a conversation with you, join in, share not only maybe your story of being someone who has integrated a neighborhood or has intervened and been helpful and protective when you've had new neighbors, but also some of the solutions that you have experienced that address the phenomena of move-in violence. In your book, we talk about the roots of move-in violence as we experience it now, as it has evolved, and we talk about how it has moved from a mob response to an individual response. But I want to say one thing first and get your comment on that as we move into talking about individual response, especially as we are reading about it in current media. there was this whole idea within white communities that if you had minorities moving in, that was a threat to property values. It was a threat to public and community safety and neighborhood safety. It was a change of life that was not welcome. But we're not talking about necessarily having quote-unquote criminals move in. We're talking about a response to any minority, and especially the idea that in some way, shape, or form, any minority who moved into a neighborhood, even if they were a professional person whose income and education might even be higher than the median, was a threat and was a damage to the community. Now, can you talk a little bit about the myths of that whole perception?
Yes. In my book, I describe something that I identify as the integration nightmare, that many perpetrators believe that, you know, one person of color moves into the neighborhood and suddenly the neighborhood is going to turn overnight. That is, as I indicate, just a nightmare, and it's not borne out by the empirical realities of the contemporary experience, meaning, as you suggest, frequently the individuals who are attacked for moving to white neighborhoods have a class status that is higher than the neighborhood in particular. So the likelihood that other minorities are going to move in and the neighborhood is going to turn overnight is exceedingly low, and, you know, just doesn't happen anymore. That was based on a particular set of circumstances that don't exist, just don't exist anymore. So it's important that individuals notice that when someone moves in, that, you know, you're sort of believing in a sort of fiction that doesn't occur anymore.
We welcome your calls at 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our first caller. Good morning, Michael. Michael?
Hello?
Good morning. That's you.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to ask the question. You talk about integration. I'd like for you to also address gentrification, because we have two different dynamics occurring here. Gentrification, to me, is the reversal of integration. And you're having, instead of blacks want to go into white neighborhoods, now you have whites that want to come into black neighborhoods. And when they come in, they're changing the whole ethnic makeup of a neighborhood. And then once they've changed the makeup of that neighborhood, then the racist attitudes now are in a neighborhood where blacks used to stay. Blacks can't even walk around in neighborhoods that they used to freely move around in before the gentrification starts. So I'd like for you to address gentrification and how that plays a part in your evaluation. Thank you.
Gentrification has led to neighborhood conflicts, but it's very interesting. I've looked briefly at this issue, and I haven't seen situations in which whites who move to neighborhoods that are predominantly minority experience the same sort of harassment or violence directed at them. I've looked at this issue in Chicago, where gentrification is quite significant as individuals want to be in the city and close to all of the amenities that exist in the city. I certainly know that there are tensions in New York City over individuals who have moved to
Harlem.
Yeah, moved to Harlem, mm-hmm. and have had problems with traditionally African American institutions, drumming, for instance. So I certainly have seen the types of phenomenon that the caller expressed.
I appreciate what the caller said is kind of a flip of the dynamic, but it's something I think a little different also with the idea of having the whites move out of the neighborhood. We coined the phrase white flight, but I think that it's really important to list some of the other factors that are part of this whole white flight that are, well, they're basically instituted by a lot of white institutions, and that is the fact that economically you'll have a neighborhood that for whatever reason may attract minorities, and then you'll have the whites move out and seek other avenues or seek other places to be. And sometimes that's because exclusively they don't want to live with people of color. But on another sense, you also have to deal with what the local jurisdiction is doing in terms of investing in those neighborhoods. You've got businesses that decide that they don't want to be there anymore, and so they make it less attractive. Or you have new areas of development, like the suburbs were in the 70s for some communities, and it poses an attractive alternative, so to speak, to a diverse neighborhood. And so you have whites moving out in that respect. And so gentrification is a flip, but it's a different type of flip, it seems to me. Is that something you found as well?
Yes, it is certainly different. And I want to add to the list of institutions that were responsible, certainly real estate agents, Blockbusters, who whipped up fears of minority turnover in neighborhoods and sought to encourage individuals to leave after African Americans bought in particular neighborhoods.
And can you define Blockbusters for us?
Blockbusters, unscrupulous investors, mm-hmm, who go into particular neighborhoods and convince individuals to leave the neighborhood because they suggest that there is going to be rapid racial turnover. And they're, in fact, creating the turnover, mm-hmm, by convincing people to leave. But again, this is a phenomenon that is very time sort of, you know, situated, meaning it's something that was frequent in the 1970s.
You're listening to More Talk Radio, and we're speaking with Professor Janine Bell, author of the book Hate Thy Neighbor, Move In Violence, and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing. Join the conversation at 503-231-8187. And we're speaking with Jackson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Miss Celeste and Cecil, for having this guest. Ms. Janine, I have a question. It's like a two-part question. And that question is, what role does the banking industry play in housing discrimination, and how deep is the industry's involvement in redlining today? And the follow-up question is, based on the facts of the discrimination in loans and how there was a big lawsuit last year and how the banking industry lost, but I noticed how quiet it was and how everyone was wondering how there was going to be compensation to the victims of this banking discrimination and banking discrimination based on loans. And also, has there been any investigation any deeper into the banking industry, banking industry's discrimination on the loan process, and have anyone discovered Is it a collective issue in the banking industry, or are the CEOs secretly saying, well, make sure you wink, wink, nod, certain brown people who are involved in this? Because I'm just noticing banking. I keep following all the roads back to banking somehow. And the people who control the banking industry and how there's lack of diversity in the banking industry itself, and whether or not it's a direct mirror of the people who live in the white neighborhoods, who in their hearts don't want any blacks living with them, or they're who they're connected to as far as family concerned, their relatives, or, you know, like I said before, can it be drawn back to an individual person? I, for one, am still waiting for the documentary to come out, really investigating banking, but I'm noticing how every time banking and discrimination comes up, it's really swept under the rug in a very swift and efficient way by our media, and how many minority leaders, prominent ones, they never bring it up either.
Well, thank you for your question. That's a good question, Professor Bell.
Okay.
I'm not an expert on the financial industry. It would not, however, surprise me if individuals involved in the banking industry have played a role in this for personal reasons, as the caller suggests. After all, individuals involved in the banking industry are white, are more likely to live not in integrated neighborhoods but in segregated neighborhoods. And moreover, the federal government, and this goes back to before the Fair Housing Act was passed, supported the creation of segregated neighborhoods through its lending practices. So the bank individuals in the banking industry have long had a history of following federal guidelines that suggest that we should see particular neighborhoods, white neighborhoods, as more worthy than even neighborhoods that are quite good but integrated. So it would not surprise me in the slightest.
Well, a follow-up question concerning the gentrification. What role did the banking play in gentrification insofar as perhaps giving minorities or brown people a lack of opportunity as far as businesses in their neighborhoods to bring them up and they not be dilapidated in the first place? Because I'm noticing a lot of these businesses that bring in the gentrification, or I dare say the beautification, insofar as municipalities coming in and repairing roads and making them look attractive, and how all of a sudden when gentrification comes, everyone's keeping that neighborhood up, and how banking is like appears to be coddling those a certain group of people. The banking appears to be coddling certain people in the gentrification process, and how a lot of brown people appear to be being pushed out as a result of all this, and what role banking plays in this. And again, I will take your answer off the air. Thank you very
right.
much for your
Thank
time.
You for your call, Jackson.
It would, again, it would not surprise me that the banking industry, given its history, would play some role in supporting neighborhoods that look as if they are whitening, as opposed to neighborhoods that remain segregated black.
You're listening to KBOO Radio. Coming up this morning at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour, a look at Egypt and the potential for democracy, a review of Susanna Moore novel, The Life of Objects. Wobbly's Adam and Daisy talk about the class dimensions of worker ownership schemes. And Yasmin Nair, on anti-discrimination for the LGBTQ community and the need to build a broader movement to fight at-will labor law. At 10, we'll hear an interview with Miko Peled, an Israeli peace activist and the author of The General's Son. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Ryan Alexander of Taxpayers for Common Sense about the cumulative effects of the shipping millions of tons of coal via train from Montana and Wyoming to ports on the West Coast. At 11, hear Disability Awareness with host Grace Reed. At 11:30 on Radio Zine, hear a conversation with local author Shannon P.S. Bonet, sharing moments of her life from her memoir, Mommy, Are You Listening? Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our one-day flash drive this past Friday. If you missed it, you can still become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Right now, you're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest is Professor Jeanine Bell, author of Hate Thy Neighbor, Move in Violence, and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing. Dr. Bell, as we talk about the persistence of housing segregation, and more particularly in terms of violence that people face when they come into communities, that seems to be an ongoing problem. And as you suggested earlier, some local authorities are better able, more willing to investigate these activities and to bring the full force of law enforcement against those who perpetuate such violence. I think for many people more recently, and I think you did write an article in the San Francisco newspaper recently, in terms of the Trayvon Martin case. But what I think you pointed out in that article was the how it relates to this idea of move-in violence and the idea of the other and the continuing threat that people might face in their own communities. Would you want to expand any on your thoughts of that?
Yes. One of the points I made in my op-ed is that the crux of the matter is that African Americans remain suspicious as neighbors, despite the lack of federal barriers to their living anywhere they want, that they can afford. Even in an integrated community, George Zimmerman's neighborhood was integrated. Even in an integrated community, the idea was that an African American man was suspicious. And that's a real problem in America today. And it's a problem because we valorize exclusively white neighborhoods or nearly white neighborhoods. And it's something that, as a society, we need to address.
And go ahead.
And as a society, we need to address. And also, you mentioned the continuing patterns of housing segregation. And I'm wondering, especially since I would think this will impact more middle and upper class Black. More so than lower income Blacks in terms of facing violence by integrating neighborhood, is it a reason that neighborhoods, maybe professional Blacks, resist moving into these segregated housing neighborhoods is because they don't want to experience that type of violence?
Don't want to be a target.
Is that the type of conversations people have?
There is some evidence that that part of the reason writ large there isn't quite as much is because of these incidents, the worry about these incidents. And of course, when incidents happen, they're publicized. Mm-hmm. I found you know, over a 20-year period, more than 400 incidents, a 20-year recent period, more than 400 incidents that were published in the newspaper, right? So there is some publicity for such incidents. And, you know, it's not just the newspaper. You may know of someone that something happened to, and it may be a disincentive, but there is also treatment in these particular neighborhoods that serves as its own disincentive. Individuals frequently leave when something happens. And when they leave, sadly, they go back to neighborhoods that are more segregated. It's not as if they are crimed out and they choose another white neighborhood.
Two things out of this 20-year study that you did from 1990 to 2010. You pointed out that, yes, there were over 400 incidents that were reported to the media, but that this is just the tip. This is a phenomenon that is more often than not underreported. And what was your experience in doing your research and finding that this is the tip, that there are frequently more incidents that are reported? Is it a matter of people being afraid to step up and say, this is what happened? Is it a matter of the media not really caring to publicize the fact that this is happening? Is it a combination or things even that we haven't discussed yet?
Well, it's a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a decline in newspaper reporting over time as mm-hmm. part of the industry-wide issues. And more, these are also very small incidents. So if, say, for instance, you sort of find some, you know, someone leaves some feces on your doorstep, you're not going to call the police about that. The next incident where someone breaks a window, you might call the police, but you might not. After all, it would be easier if you're one of very few African Americans in your neighborhood to think of it as, you know, those kids, you know, teenage kids just not doing anything. Several incidents may have to happen before an individual decides to acknowledge that this particular incident is serious enough to call the police. That's why, in part, I described it as a tip of the iceberg. And individuals may just leave, right?
Mm-hmm.
Decide that the neighborhood is not as safe as they thought, when in reality they were being targeted.
Right. So, in other words, it's kind of like internalizing or projecting the issue, but not really addressing it as the crime it is and as the ongoing crime that it is that's pushing them out.
Right. It's a lot safer to move because a particular neighborhood has too much vandalism for you than to acknowledge that, listen, you're targeted because you don't look like the type of person that should be in that neighborhood. If you admit that, then there's not really any white neighborhood where you can live if you're African American, because you can't change your face.
We talk a lot in terms of race, but there's a chapter in your book that discusses race and class and how class can trump race in terms of motivating interclass cases. Can you explain a little bit about what that is, what that dynamic is about, and how it connects to the whole idea of still resisting integration and resisting the other?
Yes, it's very interesting. It was interesting to me to find these sorts of crimes directed at upper-class minorities
mm-hmm.
By working-class whites One of the most, I describe in the book, one of the most expensive fires in Maryland history involved a fire directed at a development in which there were several million-dollar homes purchased by African Americans, and the perpetrators, working-class whites, were quite clear that they burned the neighborhood down or set fire to the homes because they were not keen on rich black people moving in.
So this is not a case of anybody bringing property values down. What they're basically doing is just expressing, once again, they don't want to live in a diverse neighborhood in a world, or rather in a community that reflects the fact that the world is not monolithic and not one color.
Correct. So they, and this is typical of perpetrators generally, they don't belong to groups that have any ideological connection, like Klan. They're not mm-hmm. Klan members. They're not organized sort of hate mongers, neo-Nazis, or anything like that. But that essentially is their belief. Correct.
Kind of boggles the mind. I'm sitting here trying to process how we even start to move beyond this when what you have is a philosophy and an ideology that says stay with your own kind, so to speak. Don't move in with us, and it's not about the fact that our property values would change or maybe even improve. It's just the fact that I don't want to live next door to you. I don't want to experience anything of your culture or anything of your ethnicity. And how do we even get past this? How do we work to change hearts? Because even with the few laws that are on the books and are selectively enforced, the fact is we're dealing with an ideology. We're dealing with a mindset that doesn't see logic at all.
Well, that it's important to note for perpetrators, they are not being logical in the slightest. There is, however, a vast middle. I began this conversation noting that I personally, my family, integrated neighborhoods. Every neighborhood I've lived in my entire life has been a white neighborhood. We have been warmly welcomed by our family. This goes back, to the 1970s. So there is a vast middle, right? And there are also individuals who may be frightened to reach out. Frightened, reluctant, unthinking about the implications of staying silent. In the book, I argue that this vast middle needs to do something before something happens. So though it's not American practice to anymore, sadly, to talk that much to your neighbors, if someone of color moves into your neighborhood and you're white, you might say, hey, welcome. I have a couple kids. Would you mind, coming over one Saturday or something like that? This is a situation where we need to resist our contemporary American culture, which is, we kind of stay separate.
And I think the other part is just recognizing that there is this human desire to improve the situation. People who move into better neighborhoods are not necessarily looking to be pioneers to get back to that, but maybe they live in a place where there's no investment, no business investment, no financial investment, no municipal investment in the neighborhood, and maybe they would like to live in a community that has, sidewalks and lights and playgrounds.
Right, right. That's absolutely right.
As this conversation continues, one thing I've noticed is, as a subject, is is that of fear of the unknown, mm-hmm. fear of the others. And a listener called in and wanted to ask about gated communities. And she said, is this part of the problem? Gated community, I imagine by creating that atmosphere of fear of the other.
Yeah, this bunker mentality.
Yes, I think that they're a problem, but they're no more a problem than communities that don't have gates that are policed by violence in fear in the same way.
And so, as we kind of wrap this up, first I'd like to extend an invitation to talk more, because I want to talk about this in a larger sense. Some of the other books that you've written really address the whole idea of how we get along in housing and how not only our personal attitudes keep each other out, but how there are legislative tools, there are laws also that keep people out. But more importantly, as we wrap up today, what else can we do besides just being warm and welcoming to folks to help diminish this this dynamic of violence, so that people do have the opportunity and feel welcome in using that opportunity to improve their situation?
We can speak out when something happens. Best case scenario, you've extended yourself before something happens. And if a horrible event happens, frequently no one who lives in the neighborhood says, listen, this is one individual in the neighborhood. We don't support this. This individual is a valued member of our community. Now, there are communities where this does happen, and I write about communities where this has happened. One of my favorite involved one community where the council person says, listen, this is not how we act, and we're going to find out who did this, and we're going to run them out of town on a rail. That is very welcoming to the individual that has experienced violence. That suggests to them that they are a valued member of the community. So that's something that can and should happen.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bell. And again, we want to extend an invitation to continue this conversation at a later time. But for our listeners, I want to commend to them your book, Hate Thy Neighbor, Move-In Violence and the Persistence of Racial Segregation in American Housing. And the publisher is the New York University Press. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to More Talk Radio, where we address issues, information, topics, and trends, and I'll call it in the course of human events. But in the course of human events, if you want to be connected to each other, this is your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 if you're in the Columbia River area. And the South in Corvallis and Philomath, it's 104.3. And on the web, kboo.fm. Stay tuned here, because we work hard to connect and make you feel welcome.
Cascadia, half an hour of news in 15 minutes. weekdays at 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. It's the end of the news as you know it.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is just coming up on 9 a.m. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater. Featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks, KBOO, for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. Friends of KBOO can be reached at 503-788-2533. Up next, the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. I wish I was a mole in the ground. Well, I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. If I was standing on the top, I'd be sure to fall.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM Portland, broadcasting at 90.7 and streaming at kboo.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from a term that Karl Marx used to describe the forces of revolution, that worthy pioneer that grubs, burrows, digs, undermines, agitates, and will someday root down the mountain of capitalism that threatens to bury us all. It's no accident the Old Mole Variety Hour is hosted on KBOO FM Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station where small-d democracy lives. If any listeners to The Mole are not yet members of KBOO,